In the preaching of the gospel, Jesus Christ himself is proclaimed. In the Lord's Supper, Jesus Christ himself is set forth. This teaches us that God very clearly wants all his people to behold his Son, the one in whom God shines forth his glory. This Son is present by word and spirit in both official means of grace by the Holy Spirit. This is therefore what we need: the vision and presence of Jesus Christ. That's what this church needs. This is what Moses needed here. Moses was, of course, the one whom God had eternally decreed to lead Israel out of Egypt and into or to the promised land. To this work, Moses needed a call. And the Lord could have purposed to call Moses in various ways. We wouldn't have needed this scene in Mount Sinai. God, for instance, could have simply spoken to Moses one night and said, "Moses, now you're called. Go to Pharaoh and bring my people out of Egypt." God didn't do that. Why not? Because God had a better plan, a better way of calling Moses that was more fitting for the work he had to do. Now Moses, he already knew that God was going to use him to deliver Israel. In Acts 7 verse 25, in the speech of Stephen, directly asserts this. And if Moses had wanted, he had things he could have used to quibble with God. There was, first of all, his age. By this time, Moses was 80. Chapter 7, verse 7 teaches us that. You will remember, it's even taught to the children in catechism class, that Moses' 120 years are divided neatly into three equal parts. For the first 40 years, he was a prince in Egypt. For the next 40 years, he was a shepherd in Midian. And then, for 40 years, he was the leader of Israel. So the question then is, why had the Lord taken 80 years before calling Moses to his great life's work? Because here's this godly man, and he's 80 before he is called to church office. And this is something for men who aspire to special office in the church to consider. Moses wasn't called till he was 80. God's way varies with each individual, but this never changes. He calls to special office at the time which is for our own good and, even more importantly, for the good of his church. Because all things, especially things like this, work together for good for those who love God. Then there was Moses' job. Moses was a shepherd. Here's a man with amazing academic qualifications. He has received a top education, perhaps as good an education as was possible in that day, at Pharaoh's court. Here's a man with great ability. Stephen the deacon put it like this: Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. But here we have this scholarly prince, and he's working as a shepherd for 40 years in some Midianite backwater. And he wasn't even caring for his own sheep. He apparently didn't own any. They were the sheep of his father-in-law, we're told in chapter 3, verse 1. Moses spent 40 years, nay 80 years, learning especially meekness. Course 101 in meekness took 40 years in Pharaoh's court. Course 102 in meekness took another 40 years in wilderness pastures. And after all this training, and many more years, we read in Numbers 12, verse 13, that Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. He had learned his lesson well. It took him long enough. And this was a man who needed to be supremely meek, because he had to lead Israel, a very stiff-necked, rebellious, and unbelieving people for the most part. And it took 80 plus years to make him meek enough to take that calling. Striking too that the Lord called Moses when he was working. And the principle here is that God does not call a lazy or an idle man. And that's a very important principle. Because if you cannot serve Jesus Christ in the small things, then you can't serve him in the large things. And if you can't be faithful doing small things, you're never going to be faithful doing larger things. Moses here is working with sheep when he's called. He's going to be looking after different sheep for the next 40 years. Both sets of sheep belong to someone other than himself. Someone close to Moses. In the first instance, Jethro, his father-in-law, and next, Jehovah, his father's God. Then we come back, though, to this call of Moses. A very distinctive form of a call. Moses was called through a call which involved a bush. A bush that burned. A bush which burned but didn't burn up. And in the midst of this bush, there's the angel of the Lord, who is Jesus Christ. And this teaches us that Moses didn't just need a call. It wouldn't have done if God had woken Moses in the middle of the night and said, "Moses, now's the time for you to go back to Egypt. You're called." Moses needed, more importantly, and alongside a call, he needed a vision of Jesus Christ. And he needed a vision of Jesus Christ which was suited to his work and calling, which is, as we shall see, exactly what we have here in Exodus 3, and especially now the first 10 verses. And the general principle holds good for us. This is what we need. A vision of Jesus Christ to inspire and sustain us in all of our callings, whatever they may be. We need to see Christ. That's it. Consider then, Christ in the burning bush. First, we'll answer the question, who? And second, where? Christ in the burning bush, who? And where? The first thing it seems to me we need to do is indeed to prove that the angel of the Lord here is Jesus Christ. And we're going to do this going through the appropriate parts of Exodus 3 verses 1 through 10. Verse 2 begins, "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto Moses." We don't read of angels, which would suggest created angels. We don't read of an angel of the Lord appearing. It says the angel of the Lord with a definite article. This angel is the distinctive, particular, and preeminent angel. And I need to say a word about angel, because this would suggest to us a created angel, one of those whom God made in the beginning. We need to understand that the word angel means messenger, one who is sent. And so often in the Bible it refers to created angels, heavenly beings, but it can also, and this is the key idea of the word itself, simply mean one who is sent by God as the second person of the Holy Trinity was sent into the world born of the Virgin Mary, and yet he wasn't an angel, and yet he was God. Sent is the idea. And maybe we should even speak of the messenger of the Lord to get that point across. Verse 4 says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. This verse begins telling us that the Lord, Jehovah, saw that Moses turned aside. Jehovah is always used of the one true God. And so this hypothetically either means the God of heaven and earth, who is everywhere present, saw that Moses had turned, or it's a reference to the angel or messenger in the bush who saw a few yards away Moses turn and draw near. The verse continues though, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush. So God, who is the Lord, who saw that Moses turned aside, God is here said to be in the midst of the bush, which is precisely where the messenger is. Therefore, the angel or messenger is God, and he is the Lord Jehovah. We're building a case here. Then listen to the words of the angel or messenger in verse 6. I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I'm God, says this angel. I'm the God of your father, Moses. That father's name was Amram. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I am their God because I appeared to them and they served me and obeyed me and worshipped me. I'm their God, and they knew that I was their God. For instance, Abraham, the angel of the Lord, Christ, appeared to him in Genesis 18, and Abraham fell down before him and prayed to him to deliver Lot when Sodom would go up in smoke. And in chapter 22, the angel of the Lord spoke to Abraham out of heaven and told him not to plunge his dagger into the heart of his son. Jacob wrestled with the angel of the Lord by the brook in Genesis 32, and Jacob thanked this angel or messenger of the Lord for redeeming him from all evil in Genesis 48. This angel is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the one too who walked in the midst of the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, as some of us have seen together recently in catechism class. He is the one who spoke on at least two occasions with Hagar in Genesis 16 and Genesis 21. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and indeed of all the fathers. I have appeared. I, this angel, have appeared many times in the past, and I'm going to appear many times in the future as the God of the believing Israelites in the Old Testament. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In a debate with the Pharisees, Christ quoted this text as proof of the resurrection from the dead. He said, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And if God speaks, thus I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are not simply lying rotting in some grave. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive and with God, having God as their God in heaven. And therefore, they're going to be raised bodily at the last day. Back in Exodus chapter 3, look with me at the end of verse 6. After the angel says, I'm the God of your father, etc., Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Moses got the point. In verse 7, again the angel is described as the Lord Jehovah. I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. I have seen everything that's happened to my people. I've heard their cries. I know their sufferings because of my divine omniscience. And the comments of the angel in verse 9 are very similar. And he refers to Israel as my people. The angel owns Israel in Egypt. They're mine. I know of nowhere in the Bible where a created angel ever refers to the church as my people. The church is God's, and it belongs to the divine messenger. In verse 8, this divine messenger is Israel's deliverer. He is the one who effects the exodus from Egypt. He is the one who brings about the conquest of Canaan. And therefore he is the one also who leads Israel through the wilderness from Egypt to the promised land. The angel does this. I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, says the messenger of the Lord. And I will bring them up out of that land unto a land that is good and large and flowing with milk and honey, and currently belongs to the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Jebusites and all the rest, and I'm going to dispossess them and give it to you because I own the whole world. I am God. And if you keep your eyes peeled and read with understanding through the rest of the Pentateuch, you'll see this angel in Exodus 14, and he's there when Israel crosses the Red Sea. You'll see him mentioned in Exodus 23, and at the end of Exodus 33 and the start of Exodus 34 as the one who leads Israel through the wilderness and brings them into the promised land. And then after Moses dies and Joshua takes his place, this angel appears as the captain of the host of the Lord to Joshua and says, you work for me and I'm going to conquer the land and I'm going to give it to you. I'm the angel of the Lord and I've been with you all the way. This messenger is God. And perhaps of all the passages which speak of the angel of the Lord, this one in Exodus 3 indicates most frequently, most clearly, and in the most varied ways that this messenger is God. It's Christ in the midst of the burning bush. It's a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. This means that Christ appears here to Moses before he became flesh of the Virgin Mary. And Christ comes here not in that human nature which he would later assume in Mary's womb, but he appears here in a temporary human form. That's why he's called the angel of the Lord, the messenger, the great messenger of God, the one whom Jehovah sends as his special messenger at particular key moments because he's his best messenger. And Christ is the best messenger because he is Jehovah, the second person of the Holy Trinity. Moses receives this vision of Christ at his call because that is precisely what Moses needed. Gideon saw Christ at his call in Judges 6, because that's what Gideon is. And Isaiah did in chapter 6 too. And Ezekiel did in Ezekiel chapter 1. And Paul did in Acts 9. Christ appeared to sustain and empower all those whom he called, especially when the going is hard. And that's what we need. That's what you need more than anything else, to see Jesus Christ. That's why you come to church. But now, where does Christ appear? And where does Moses see him? Well, Christ does not just appear standing before Moses. Christ doesn't appear beside a mighty cedar tree, or by a vine, or a fig tree, or an olive tree. Christ appears here in a bush. And the Hebrew verb from which this word bush comes means thorny or bristling. So we're dealing with a thorn bush, maybe even a bramble, but definitely a thorn bush. And this bush, as all agree, is the church. The church is portrayed as a bush. It's not a great and mighty tree like an oak or a cedar. It's not even an average sized sort of tree like a cypress or a fig tree. It's not even a tree at all. It's a bush or a shrub, and it's small and it's unattractive. And this bush is God's picture here of the true church in her humiliation in the world. It's not great and mighty, it's small. It's despised and not esteemed or honored by the world. This is the sort of church that Moses was going to spend the next 40 years serving, the church currently in Egypt. This is the true church throughout all of our history. This is the true church in our day, including us. It's a bush, it's a thorn bush. That's the image. And the point for us here in Exodus 3 is, this is where Christ is found. He's in the church. No matter how lowly the church is. He's in all true instituted congregations. That's the point of Revelation chapters 1, 2, and 3. Christ walks in the midst of the candlesticks. He's right in the midst of the church. And Christ is in the midst of the church because that's where he wants to be. He goes, like everybody else, where he wants to go. He dwells where he wants to dwell. He's not forced to be in the church, but he delights to dwell with his people because he loves them and their assemblies. That's where he is. And Jesus Christ, therefore, is here. He's here in the preaching. He's here in the sacraments by his word and spirit. And this is why you need to be here. And your children need to be here. Because Christ is here. Do you believe that? And Christ is in true churches as opposed to false churches. You don't go to the false church expecting to meet Christ. You will meet someone there. You'll meet the false Christ. And you'll meet Satan, because false churches are synagogues of Satan. Christ is not in the pagan religions. Despite all the pontifications of the Church of Rome, he's not there. He's not in the haunts of the ungodly world. He's in the humble church, which is a thorn bush in the wilderness. And Moses must, and Moses does see this at his call. He needs to see this, because this is what's going to sustain him in his difficult life's work. To go a step further, Christ is present in the burning bush. Not just any old bush, but the bush that burns. And the burning, we're clearly told, is the affliction in Egypt. Verse 7, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. I know their sorrows. Verse 9, the cry of the Israelites comes before me. I have seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. This fits with the whole biblical description of Egypt. You've read this many times in the Pentateuch. Egypt is a burning, fiery furnace. That's why this bush is burning. The previous two chapters of Exodus give us instances of this burning. Exodus 1 verse 11. Taskmasters are set over Israelites to afflict them. They carry heavy burdens and they build treasure cities as slaves for Pharaoh. They're burning. Verses 13 and 14, because Israel was growing numerically, they are now made to serve with rigor, with harshness, so that their lives are bitter, and they're working with mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field with rigor. And the flames are a little bit hotter now. In chapter 15, Pharaoh wants to turn up the heat yet further, so he calls the Hebrew midwives to see to it that whenever a son is born, that son is put to death. Think of the heat on Israelite fathers and mothers there, although the Hebrew midwives were faithful to the Lord. Seeing that, Pharaoh wants to turn the thing up another gas mark. So in chapter 1 verse 22, he charges all the Egyptians that if they see a little baby boy amongst the Hebrews, throw them into the river Nile. In chapter 2 verse 11, we see an Egyptian taskmaster apparently needlessly and cruelly beating a member of the Church of Christ. It's a burning bush. And the thorn bush is especially appropriate for a burning bush. Thorn bushes burn well. Thorn bushes even crackle. And this thorn bush would be particularly good because the thorn bush in a very arid land, there isn't much moisture in this little bush. It'll go up and burn very nicely. And this is the way the true church always is. God makes his church as a flammable church. He doesn't make it out of stone. He makes it out of wood. Very flammable is the church in the world. The church is flammable, and the ungodly understand that the church is flammable because in their eyes, the church is small and weak and harmless. You can attack the church. You can slander the church. You can mock the church. And nobody really bats an eyelid. Do half of those things to a Muslim, and then you've got a riot. But the church, it's flammable because Christ tells his people to be humble and meek. So the church, the true church, is always abused and persecuted all around the world and in all ages because God has made it a flammable little bush. And there is Jesus Christ, and this is where we must see him. Not only in heaven, where he is, but also in the midst of his persecuted, suffering church. As the church is burning, the flames are licking her. He's there. And he delights to be with the church even when it's suffering. Perhaps especially as it is persecuted. Because the sufferings of the church are sufferings of the church for Christ's sake. And Moses must see this. He must see this as he is called. And he does. And he understands it. And he thinks about this in later years too. And he even mentions it in his blessing of Israel in Deuteronomy 33 verse 16, just a chapter before he died. Now, this burning of the church is not only Egypt's turning up the heat, but it is also God's burning the church. God puts the church to the flame, as it were, through the wicked world. God does this because of who he is as a burning fire. And the burning fire of God purifies and refines his people through persecution and suffering. God was the one who raised up that Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. It wasn't some accident. God said, they've had a number of pharaohs who respect them. Now I want one who's going to persecute them, and I'll raise this one up. Not because he was going to destroy Israel, but because he wanted to refine and purify and cleanse her. And in the midst of all this, as God burns, God sends Christ into the midst of the church, sustaining her in her afflictions, sanctifying her by his Spirit through their afflictions, and sympathizing with her. Isaiah 63 mentions this. In all their afflictions, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence suffered with them. Christ suffered with Israel in Egypt as she passed through the flames. Christ suffered with Israel according to his human nature, not according to his divine nature, because it can't suffer. And this is why Hebrews speaks of our Lord as a sympathetic high priest, as one who is touched with the feelings of our infirmities. Christ is united and present with his church. He's united and present with his church in all her sufferings, and he feels them. And this was his word to Paul on the Damascus road. Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Because he persecuted the church. It was the same thing. And that's why various Protestant churches have taken the burning bush for their symbol. The French Huguenots were a burning bush. Later they even called themselves the Church in the Wilderness, which is where the burning bush was. Presbyterians in England, Scotland, Ireland, and as Presbyterianism has spread throughout the world, the symbol is the burning bush, and the legend underneath, though the words vary between various Presbyterian churches, are basically some variant of this: burning, yet not consumed. We're burning, and we're being purified. We're burning, and we're even growing through it, as Israel did in Egypt, but we are not consumed like this bush. There were flames, there was a fire, but there was no crackling, no smoke, no ashes. And then finally, in this connection, we must notice this too. Where was the burning bush? You see, God could have done this just outside Moses' backyard, put a bush on fire, as it were, and sent his son to speak to Moses through it. But he put this bush on Mount Sinai, and he guided Moses with the flock in search of better pasture up a mountain where there's generally more rainfall and therefore better grass, and set this scene on Mount Sinai. He put the bush there, and put Christ in the midst of the bush there, because Mount Sinai is what we might refer to as a covenant place. One of the greatest manifestations of God's everlasting covenant of grace came at Mount Sinai with the giving of the law and the tabernacle and the shaking and quaking of Mount Sinai. It's a place of the covenant. God draws Moses' attention to that after Moses' first objection in Exodus 3 verse 11. God says, I'm going to be with you, and here's a sign When you bring forth Israel out of Egypt, you will serve God upon this mountain where I have put this burning bush. You're going to come back to this place where I met you according to my covenant promise in the burning bush, and then Israel is going to meet me at the exact same place. Remember, Exodus 2 verse 24, God heard their groaning in Egypt, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And then chapter 3 verse 6, the angel introduces himself to Moses. I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Abrahamic covenant. And now God meets Moses in the burning bush on Mount Sinai, and then later on he's going to bring about the Mosaic covenant in the same place. God meets his people in the covenant of grace. He does the same thing this morning in the Lord's Supper. Jesus said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. You meet God in the covenant of grace. That's the idea. And in the sacrament, God says to us, you need to see my Son. You need his presence spiritually now, not physically, carnally, as if Christ were the bread, literally. And you need to see my Son, especially in this way, my people, as he is crucified, as he is broken, as his blood is poured out for you. You need to see that rending of his body and soul, making the Lord's Supper a sort of holy ground. And that's what we're going to do now as we partake of the sacrament. Amen. Let us pray.